Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting WLRN. It'll be 1 year next Thursday since the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. The Broward School Board and Superintendent Robert Runcie have faced criticism over the past year of their responses to the shooting and events leading up to the tragedy. This week, divisions among the school board spilled out in public. Lori Olideff is a school board member. Before she was elected, she was a Parkland parent. Her daughter Alyssa was killed in the February 14th shooting. Olideff recently has pushed for public meetings on school safety across Broward County. And according to the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the district's lawyer this week would not allow the school board to vote on Olideff's request for those town hall meetings. Lori Olideff, the Broward County Public School Board member, joins us now on the South Florida Roundup via FaceTime. Board Member Olideff, what is your proposal for these meetings?
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. So I wanted these meetings to be transparent, sunshine, and open to the public. I wanted there to be district-wide meetings because everyone's voices need to be heard, and all the school board members need to hear from the communities, from all the different communities, so we can move forward with creating different policies and procedures and know what the needs are in each community specifically.
Now, are these different meetings than the meetings that the superintendent has been holding, private meetings with Parkland students and parents this week, and I think has one scheduled for Monday?
Correct. So I was pushing as my B item last school board meeting to have district-wide town hall meetings, but at MSD there is grade level meeting specifically.
Yeah. It's a B level item, B agenda items. Those are items that are suggested by board members. You are a board member. What happened at the meeting this week?
So apparently when it came up, it was told to us that my item would only be open for discussion and it would not be an action item, which I find 100% unacceptable. I clearly wanted the school board members to be voting.
And what was the explanation for the difference between a discussion item and an action item? I know we're getting into Robert's Rules of Orders here. It may be dry, but what was your understanding of what the difference was?
You know, honestly, I think it's just the superintendent trying to control the conversation and trying to control the school board and their vote. What was the big deal? Either you vote yes or you vote no.
Is it accurate that the reporting that the superintendent, that the district's lawyer would not allow a school board agenda item without the superintendent's okay?
Well, she did put an MOU describing different items that a school board member can bring as a B item moving forward. You know, I think that Ms. Bartleman got so upset because
that was a fellow school board
she's
member.
She's been on the board. Correct. And she's been on the board for, I think, 13 years now. And she's never seen a B item being questioned, being brought to the agenda.
Is a B item meant for a discussion item, or could that be an action item in your understanding?
Oh, no, absolutely. It should be an action item. You know, otherwise, like, for example, if we want to fire the superintendent, well, that needs to be an action item, and we need to vote on that. And the only way I can do that is bringing it as a B item.
I'll ask you about that in a moment, but is it accurate in your understanding as a board member, a publicly elected board member of the Broward County School Board, that the superintendent of the schools, which is an appointed position, must approve agenda items for the board?
To my understanding, it's his staff and the superintendent that approves these agenda items. You know, possibly the chair, Heather Brinkworth, might have some type of say in it.
But as a board member, can you approve an agenda item without the approval of the superintendent, the administration, or any other board member?
To be honest, I thought as a school board member, I can bring a B item forward and ask for it to be on the agenda, and it should be put on the agenda. Mm-hmm. you know, as school board members, we are the ones that are responsible for hiring and firing the superintendent. We are the superintendent's boss. So we should be able to bring items forward, and they should be action items to be voted on by the school board.
Your effort would have town hall meetings on school security throughout Broward County. The school board members, like yourself, are elected in geographic districts. Should it be up to those individual district school board members to decide how they want to engage on public school safety?
Well, it's not up to them how they should engage specifically on school safety in their district. As a school board, we decide together. But, you know, on 2/14, 17 people were shot and killed. 17 people were shot and injured. I wanted all the school board members to hear from my community the needs and what they are going through and to feel it at the humanistic level.
Yeah, well, you certainly speak with authority there, and we are sorry for your loss and continued sympathy for you and your family as we approach this, got to be an extremely painful, unimaginably painful time for you and your family as we approach this one-year marking of the tragedy. You have been in some private meetings with the superintendent, Superintendent Runcie, that he has held with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas' parents. Can you share with us what those have been like?
Sure. The parents are very angry. They're very frustrated. You know, there was one parent that brought to the superintendent a memo that he wrote in 2013 after the Sandy Hook shooting. And it clearly stated in that memo that school safety would be a top priority for the district. And one of the items in there that really upset me was that he said that school monitors and specialists would have additional training. Well, we all know what happened on 2/14, and the monitor allowed the gunman to walk in with a gun bag, and he did nothing.
Audio tape of at least one of those meetings has been leaked to the Sun Sentinel, and on it you can hear the audience calling for Superintendent Runcie's resignation. What are your thoughts on the superintendent's ongoing tenure to lead the schools?
Our community is frustrated, and not just my community. I feel like the district is the community, and the whole entire district is frustrated. They are seeing what is going on with the superintendent as that is taking precedent over the education of the children, and we need to get back to our focus. And the superintendent's He is complicating that, and not only that, he is not an effective leader, and all of the problems that led up to 2/14, he needs to be held accountable for those many failures. And also, we have a failing $800 million smart bond project, and this is going to cost the taxpayers millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Board member of Broward County Public Schools, Lorhi Aladef, along with us. Ms. Aladef, thank you for your time here. And as we approach this painful time for you and your family and for the community here in South Florida, we do wish you a moment of peace. Thank you for joining us here on the South Florida Roundup today, Lorhi.
Thank you.
You can, of course, read more coverage at WLRN.org. Join the conversation on Twitter. At WLRN is our handle there. Joining us now in studio is Rosalind Osgood. She also represents a district in Broward County on the school board. Dr. Osgood, we know that you did not listen to that portion of the interview with your colleague on the board under the advisement of school legal counsel. So I think that's important to say. Thank you for joining us on the roundup today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So this issue about district town halls regarding school safety and school security. Is this an effort that you support?
It is. And I think that the misunderstanding is sometimes when you come new to a board or a system, you don't quite know how it runs. I'm the school board member for District 5, mm-hmm. and I think since being elected in 2012, I've had 34 town hall or public meetings. It is something that a board member can schedule, can pick a date. If that board member wants staff there, they can check staff schedule and ask them to be there. It's not something that is needed for a vote or anything. And since February 14th, we've had a countywide meeting around the Promise Program, around school safety. It is something that we do in order to educate the community on what's going on and to get impact, feedback.
So it sounds like you're opposed to a mandatory town hall kind of ordinance, so to speak, to come from the school board, but instead you as a school board member to have the flexibility and to retain the decision yourself about whether or not you have a town hall in your district.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Okay. What I'm saying is that there is nothing to prevent it from happening. There is no need for an ordinance or a policy because I represent a district that could want a town hall meeting about whatever topic. Mm-hmm. And as a school board member, I'm elected by the people and I have to be able to respond to them. Now, in listening on the dais in the school board meeting the other day, my colleague was making a point that she wanted to have a town hall meeting and she wanted all other school board members present. Mm-hmm. If that is the case, then you coordinate those meetings with board members' schedule, and if they are available, they will attend. It is a common practice. We do it all the time. I've done it the last 6 years that I've been on the board. I've gone to meetings in other districts. I've had board members come to meetings in my district. So it's something that's already practical in the district.
So you don't think that it would take kind of mandatory action by the school board, a vote by the school board in order to require this kind of town hall event, either countywide or any particular school board district?
No, it's not necessary. If it's a school board member's preference, they can easily organize it. I mean,
and
I
you'd
do
prefer
it all
to retain
time.
That preference for yourself as
of
opposed
course.
To having it dictated to you by the rest of the school
right,
board,
because,
for instance.
Right, because, and I respect my colleagues enough to leave them that discretion as well.
Sure. We're talking with Dr. Rosalind Osgood, a member of the Broward County Public School Board, District 5, divisions in the school board around public town halls regarding school security, and have became public this week. What is your impression of what happened with this issue, with this effort by one of your colleagues on the school board to hold a vote on one of these so-called B items?
Well, I think that when you're new to a process, sometimes you don't understand how it works. And if you have people advising you that are not giving you the full picture, then you just don't know. I think my colleague was making an innocent attempt to have something happen that she already has the power and authority to make happen and maybe was not aware of that. For example, I'm having a meeting in February at Mural Lakes. I contacted the principal. I said, I want to come out and listen at parents mm-hmm. in the area. We set it up. My staff did the flyer, and it's a go. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to bring it to the board. The people on staff that I want there, I have asked them to be available to go. Their schedules are clear, and it's on. I think that this whole thing came about, and then it turned into something by another colleague that the school board and the superintendent was trying to be mean to our colleague that's newly elected to the board, that we were trying to control her, and it's just not right.
There are also questions about governance here. Is it your understanding that the legal counsel that the school board received is accurate in that the superintendent needs to approve board action items for an agenda?
I think what was said and what the law says is that the agenda, The superintendent brings the agenda to the board to get our approval or disapproval on items. It is his agenda. The state statute gives, I think it's 5 or 6 ways, I could be wrong on the numbers, that school board members can bring items. One of those items could be to dismiss the superintendent, but those items are brought in a way that the statutes say that they are brought. And that's what the attorney was communicating. She wasn't saying that a school board member can't bring a B item, because you certainly can. I mean, we've had them. Ms. Levinson has brought B items.
Have you brought an item on the agenda?
I have not brought a B item on the agenda.
And a B item is particularly a board member item.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
But you're confident that if you wanted to, as a board member, you could add an item to the agenda of the body you're elected to.
Certainly. And it would need to be within statute. See, the thing with the school board is a lot of the stuff we do is set by state law and state statute. Mm-hmm. And whether you like it or not, you have to follow it. And sometimes when we want to do something that statute does not allow us to do, we can't change the statute. And the staff, we hold them accountable for making sure that we're in statute. Just like I had to say to you today, I couldn't hear the other conversation. I had to have things done a certain way.
And why was that? Why do you think the legal counsel was to you that as a school board member, you couldn't even hear a conversation with another of your duly elected board members?
Because right now we had a lawsuit filed last week by the Sun Sentinel. Because two board members were in a public meeting that was not sunshine.
Mm-hmm. The law meaning that there wasn't enough public notice given, there wasn't an agenda published. The sunshine is the sunshine laws. It's a group of laws in the state of Florida that govern government, essentially
and
government
meetings.
It says
that two school board members cannot come together and discuss, keyword discuss, any item that they're going to vote on. So these two school board members were in a setting. One school board member spoke. The other school board member never commented. They never discussed anything. Mm-hmm. But the Sun Sentinel is now suing us for violation of the sunshine. Mm-hmm. So in an abundance of caution, today I can say that I never heard the previous conversation. I didn't discuss anything with the school board member prior to. And we're not collaborating on responses.
Some of these meetings that you've talked about are these private meetings the superintendent has been holding with parents at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. Have you attended any of those private meetings?
I have not attended those meetings. We've gotten feedback. We had the mayor of Parkland tell us that some of the parents expressed to her that they appreciated the private meetings without the media. Then you have others that want the meetings with the media.
Yeah.
Now, how I've been getting communication from families in Parkland is I have students there that I deal with. I have members of my church that live in Parkland. Mm-hmm. So even if you're not a district school board member, you have ways of communicating with the community.
Yeah, and hearing from the media as well. As you may know, some audio of one of those private meetings was leaked to the Sun Sentinel, which published portions of that audio. And on that audio, you can hear people, presumably parents, very angry and calling for the dismissal of Superintendent Runcie. What are your thoughts and your position regarding the superintendent's leadership now?
Well, I look at the superintendent's leadership from a holistic perspective. I represent a district that when I started, I had 12 F schools. Now I have zero F schools. I represent a district that actually has the opposite opinion about the school board and the school board's tenure. And let me tell you,
what do you mean by the opposite opinion?
Well, my district, the parents in my district think the superintendent is doing a great job. Mm. And I would go on the edge to say that so does the voters. And here's my measurement. Since February 14th, during the last election, three incumbent school board members mm-hmm. got unanimously reelected. Now, hear me on this. The district also passed a second referendum in 4 years where we asked for another tax. The voters said yes to those three school board members, and they said yes to the referendum.
The referendum was for teacher pay and school security.
It was for, pay, school security, caseworkers. Mm-hmm. So the voters continue to show by their vote that they have confidence in the school board and the superintendent.
Dr. Osgood, thank you for coming down into studios. We appreciate it.
And thank you for having me.
Dr. Rosalyn Osgood is a Broward County Public School Board member representing District 5 in Broward County. The South Florida Roundup continues after this. Tensions continue growing in Venezuela's evolving crisis. We will talk with the Trump administration's point person regarding Venezuela coming up next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
Tendrán una decisión muy importante en sus manos. Seguir del lado de alguien que está.
Venezuelan's interim president Juan Guaido this week, he tweeted this video on Thursday calling on soldiers to allow international humanitarian aid to enter the country. Venezuela's military blocked a highway on the Colombian border that would provide a path for trucks of food and medicine to get to Venezuelans suffering with shortages and astronomical inflation, making even the most basic items too expensive for most. Now, the United States and several countries have recognized Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's regime as illegitimate. The issue came up by President Trump during the State of the Union speech this week.
We stand with the Venezuelan people in their noble quest for freedom, and we condemn the brutality of the Maduro regime.
Here in South Florida, this kind of foreign policy is local news, certainly. Venezuelan expats have been rallying in solidarity. Belén Marrero helped organize a pro-democracy rally in Doral last weekend, the same time when anti-Maduro marches were happening in Caracas and across Venezuela.
Nobody believe in our fight because no, they are like a Cuba. No, they lost the country. No, my father was Cuban. I have the memory of his history. I have on my heart all the time the strength to still fight.
Cuba and Venezuela have had a long-standing relationship, but now the U.S. government is looking to Havana in how it approaches the crisis in Venezuela with what some call the Cubanization of Venezuelan policy. Your thoughts. What do you want to know about the situation in Venezuela? What are the experiences that you have with friends or family, perhaps, on the ground there? You can text us here on the South Florida Roundup. Text 786-786-7636. Text us your thoughts, your questions that you have about this crisis and the diplomacy and other options that the United States government say are on the table. Text 786-786-7636. This morning, WLRN's Tim Padgett and I spoke with Ambassador Carlos Trujillo, the U.S. representative to the Organization of American States. Ambassador Trujillo, is there anything more the United States ought to be doing in regards to the situation on the ground in Venezuela?
Well, the United States has shown its commitment by recognizing the interim president of Juan Guaido. We've also committed $100 million in aid and an additional $20 million just last week. We are doing as much as we possibly can at this moment.
Is the United States conducting any action on the ground or around Venezuela?
Well, the United States is committed to the humanitarian effort. We, USAID, along with the State Department and other people, have been working on facilitating the bringing of humanitarian aid to Colombia and the border region.
Mr. Ambassador, those tons of U.S. and international humanitarian aid are sitting on the Colombian side of the border in Cúcuta this morning. The Venezuelan regime has, on the other side, barricaded the bridge so that it cannot enter. How does the United States and the international community plan at this point to move that aid into Venezuela?
I think one thing you have to understand is that there are two bridges. There's the Simón Bolívar Bridge, which is a pedestrian bridge.
Right.
The aid is sitting on the other side of that one. There's also another bridge. That's the one that you see on the famous pictures of the aid being barricaded. The aid will still reach the people of Venezuela. Ideally, it would reach inside of Venezuela, and there are multiple people working on a strategy and a plan to make that happen. But there are 40 to 50,000 migrants that do cross across Venezuela to Colombia through the Cúcuta Bridge that will be receiving all that aid and will be returning back to Venezuela, the majority of them.
In the broader picture, Mr. Ambassador, the United States has said it is not interested in negotiating with Mr. Maduro in Venezuela with regards to future more legitimate presidential elections. If the strategy of financial and diplomatic pressure that we are taking in tandem with the international community does not work in terms of dislodging Mr. Maduro in the next few months, will it become necessary for us to negotiate with him the way we have in the past with other Latin American dictators like Augusto Pinochet in Chile, for example, a generation ago?
Well, I believe our strategy is going to work. I think we're going to be successful, and I don't think it's going to be a couple of months. The premise of whether we should negotiate with Maduro, an illegitimate tyrant who's running a narco state, is something that is not in our best interest. It's not in the region's best interest. The majority of the leaders in Latin America refuse to negotiate with him. We've tried in years past to negotiate with Maduro, tried to negotiate with his interlocutors, with Diosdado Cabello. All that we've seen is additional human rights violations, the politicization of food, and their failure to even recognize the humanitarian need that's affecting their country.
Should other Latin American countries be doing more to isolate the Maduro regime and to help in the humanitarian situation?
They are. If you look at the Latin American continent, besides Bolivia and Uruguay, every other country has recognized Juan Guaido as the interim constitutional president of of Venezuela. If you look at Central America, except for Nicaragua, and Mexico, every other country has recognized Juan Guaido as the interim president. Obviously, the United States, Canada, 45 other countries have recognized Juan Guaido. Colombia this week has canceled visas for high-ranking Venezuelan officials. Panama has passed similar to our global Magnitsky sanctions against corrupt individuals and corrupt enterprises. So the region has really coalesced around isolating Maduro.
The military in Venezuela is still obviously the key here. Without the military, Maduro does not remain in power. What more can the United States and the international community be doing to convince the military command in Venezuela to abandon Maduro and move to the interim president, Mr. Guaido?
Well, I think the National Assembly and the interim president offering amnesty to certain military officials is a great start. It starts the reconciliation process within the country. The United States government has made on multiple occasions offers that individuals who are currently sanctioned or who will be sanctioned in the very near future have an opportunity to right some of their wrongs and to start cooperating with the democratically elected government.
Mr. Ambassador, what role does Cuba play in the U.S. response to Venezuela?
Cuba is currently occupying Venezuela. The Cuban influence on intelligence, on security, on military force, the torture that's happening at the Sabine, their military headquarter, is all run by the Cuban operation.
When you say that Cuba is occupying Venezuela, what do you mean by that?
There's tens of thousands of Cuban soldiers who are currently stationed inside of a sovereign country, inside of Venezuela. Juan Guaido, the interim president, does not want him to be there. The majority of the Venezuelan people do not want him to be there. They have occupied a sovereign nation through military intervention.
Along those lines, Mr. Ambassador, it's been hard for the media not to notice that the three-point men really in the Trump administration on the Venezuelan strategy, you yourself, Mauricio Claver Colon in the White House, and Senator Marco Rubio are all Cuban-Americans. What do you say to those who suggest that the real end game of bringing down the Venezuelan regime is in reality to eventually bring down the Cuban regime?
Well, as Ambassador Bolton said in his speech in Miami, it's a troika of tyranny. It's not only the Cuban regime, the Venezuelan regime, but the Nicaraguan regime. All three tyrants happen to be intertwined. And as if we are successful, as we will be on our Venezuela policy, the Cuban economy will not be able to survive and hopefully will lead to democratic change.
You mentioned before, Mr. Ambassador, that you have confidence that these pressures will work in bringing down the Maduro regime if within months, if not within weeks. But this is one of the most ideologically robotic regimes we have in this hemisphere. They are not going to go quietly. Do you worry that if this doesn't happen as perhaps as soon as you would like, that we could start seeing violence within Venezuela itself, civil war style of violence?
We hope that that won't happen. We've already seen violence by the regime towards a lot of their opponents. We've seen members of the military who've denounced the regime, tortured and disappeared. We've seen students that have been arbitrarily detained and killed. There's some videos on Twitter and social media that reflect that. So the violence is already occurring. We obviously would never advocate for a civil war within Venezuela. The governance of the country is impossible for Maduro to continue. When you have millions of people leaving, 1,000,000% hyperinflation, and you're blocking basic humanitarian needs, at some point the military has to act. They have to support the society. They have to honor the Constitution, and they have to honor their oaths.
And if, hypothetically, the regime were to fall tomorrow, how long would it take, how arduous a task would it be for the United States and the international community and the opposition to rebuild not just democracy, but more importantly, this catastrophically destroyed economy in Venezuela?
It's a monumental task. The Venezuelans have started working on their plan. They call it Plan País. They had a conference last week in Ottawa. There's a professor in Harvard by the last name Hausman, who's been working on this plan. Obviously, it's not going to be simple. It will take a lot of time. But one of the benefits that Venezuela has is all the natural resources that the majority of Latin America or the majority of the world don't exist. So I believe with their natural resources and some of the plans that they've already put in place, they'll be able to recover economically.
And again, if this does not happen as timely a fashion as we hope, is, as the administration has so often said, is U.S. military intervention still on the table?
The president said on multiple occasions, as Ambassador Bolton has said the same, that all options are on the table. But if you really have to analyze the history of what's happening and how monumental of a moment this is, the last 18 years regarding Venezuelan policy, there has never been an opportunity like the one we're experiencing today, in which the majority of the region and the larger democratic countries of the world are recognizing Guaido and calling for democratic change and calling for diplomatic and economic isolation of Maduro. We are very positive on how this has progressed. From January 24th until today, in less than 2 weeks or 3 weeks, we're in a much better position today to bring about democracy to Venezuela than we were 4 or 5 or 6 weeks ago.
The United States has put on a number of sanctions on individuals and on companies in Venezuela, most notably, of course, the National Oil Company, which is the biggest natural resource that Venezuela has, Mr. Ambassador. As recently as October of 2018, the United States was importing thousands of barrels of oil a day from Venezuela. Should the United States cease all imports of Venezuelan oil?
Well, with the Petrovesa sanctions and the SICO sanctions, by and large, that money now will not go to the Maduro regime. And I think one thing that's important is as the country rebuilds, they're going to need capital. That money is being held in the United States for the recognized government of President Juan Guaido as a transition. So it's very important to note that the Maduro regime is not receiving any additional money. And all the money that he had through Petrovesa in the United States, which was in the multi-billions, has been seized and has been preserved for the interim government and for the future democratically elected president of the country. We've also put a lot of pressure on the expropriation of gold that we've seen that as they are trying to flight their capital, pulling it out of either London or trying to move it to Turkey or through Russia. We've put pressure through our sanctions and through our executive orders to make sure that there's no flight of capital.
What is an acceptable exit of Maduro from Caracas and Venezuela look like for the United States?
He immediately stops the control of power and exits the country is the only acceptable remedy for us.
Ambassador Carlos Trujillo is the U.S. representative to the Organization of American States, former Florida House member from Dade County. So what options are left for the United States with Venezuela? What is that role of Cuba in this relationship? How is South Florida responding? You can call us 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-WLRN. You can also send us a text, 786-786-7636. What are your thoughts on the Venezuelan situation? What are you hearing from friends and family who may still be in country? 786-786-7636 is the text line. We'll get to all that next as the South Florida Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Well, you just heard an interview with Carlos Trujillo, the U.S. representative to the Organization of American States. He said he's confident the United States and international pressure will bring down the socialist regime in Venezuela, and soon. He also reminded us the larger campaign is to dislodge what the Trump administration has called Latin America's Troika of Tyranny, not just Venezuela, but the regimes in Nicaragua and in Cuba. But does the U.S. risk getting ahead of itself here or overreacting? What are the expectations in South Florida? 800-743-WLRN is the phone number to talk with us, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text at 786-786-7636. The text line is open at 786-786-7636. Tim Padgett is still with us, our Latin American correspondent here at WLRN. Franco Ordonez watches all things in the capital for McClatchy Media in Washington, D.C. He's with us from NPR headquarters in the capital city. Franco, let me ask you, first of all, what options are still left on the table? The Trump administration, you just heard from Ambassador Trujillo saying all options are on the table. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it does mean what he says it is. They are leaving open the option of military action. I will tell you that everyone that I speak to here in Washington, those close to the administration, say that is the last thing that they want to happen, that they a lot of people tell me that there is no way that would happen. But I will say some of the same people who said told me who are telling me now that that won't happen also were saying to me that they really didn't think oil sanctions would happen. The administration used the same exact line when I would ask and so many other outlets would ask, are oil sanctions on the table? Mm-hmm. Are oil sanctions coming? And the administration would say, all options are on the table. So this is the Trump administration. So, you know, anything can happen.
Anything can happen, certainly. But, Tim, it is a classic diplomatic playbook to say all options are on the table. It certainly is not exclusive to the Trump administration to not to want to take any tool that they may have to try to leverage change in a regime that they find objectionable.
But what's unique to this situation, though, is the sort of going out on the limb the way we did 2 weeks ago by recognizing Juan Guaido as the interim, the legitimate president of Venezuela. And you know, to their credit, the rest of the international community in large part came along. The problem is when you commit yourself in this way, once you get beyond that sort of short-term exhilaration that we've all been feeling these past few weeks, then all of a sudden you are so committed to this that you have to keep taking one more step, one more measure, and those measures have to be stronger than the next. As Franco just pointed out, nobody thought we would take these oil sanctions measures. What's next?
Yeah. So, Franco,
can I add to that?
Of course.
I just want to point out that I couldn't agree more. And when I would talk to senior administration officials in 2017 and 2018, they had an escalation roadmap. And it was, you know, naming Maduro a dictator, doing individual sanctions. The last one was oil sanctions. Now, if you talk to the individuals that you mentioned before and you talk about senior administration officials, they will tell you that they have more options that they can move to. But when I talk to the people who helped write that escalation roadmap, there are not that many more options to go. So Tim's exactly right.
So, Franco, we've got a question from one of our text listeners from 954 area code. Being that the bridge allowing the humanitarian aid to pass from Colombia to Venezuela is blocked, what is the next possible move? What's the next possible move in terms of humanitarian aid?
That is the million-dollar question. This weekend is a huge test to find out what is going to happen. Is the border patrol, are the border agents on the Venezuela side, are they going to listen to Maduro or are they going to listen to the people who are pleading for this aid to come in? The ambassador Trujillo kind of alluded to this. If they can't get the aid in, another thing that people are discussing is perhaps some of the Venezuelans who are coming across the border into Cucuta, maybe they can come, maybe they can fill up some backpacks or bags, and maybe they can carry them back and kind of dribble it out in a distribution way. Those are serious issues that they're trying to confront right now.
But that kind of aid, you know, Venezuelans going to Colombia bringing back aid, that's been happening for a few years now. I think what really was the end game for this aid delivery was image. This was an image-driven idea so that the world could see Maduro, and frankly, Maduro complied by putting these tanker trucks across the bridge to barricade against the aid. Mm-hmm. That photo, that aerial photo of that blockage was really, I think, what the opposition and the Trump administration was going for, to show the world this sort of North Korean-style image of a hermit republic keeping aid for its people out. And to that extent, I think it worked.
And does it also, help accelerate the exodus?
I think it could, because it heightens that sense of despair inside the country. And as a result, we could see, you know, an acceleration of the exodus.
We're talking about
absolutely.
Go ahead, Franco.
Politically speaking, it looks very bad for Maduro.
Yeah.
If that aid is stacked up and the people of Venezuela can see that aid right there, so close, you know, figuratively speaking, between their fingertips, but it's being kept from them. And Guaido's obviously saying, I want this aid for you, but someone else is stopping.
And didn't we see Brazil come out and kind of stand with Guaido since those pictures have surfaced?
Absolutely. Brazil has stepped up. The Brazil foreign minister is here actually in Washington, been meeting with Senator Rubio and other leaders on the Hill as well as on in the administration. They're absolutely standing in and, you know, supporting Guaido. As you know, you noted earlier, so many other regional and world leaders. It's an amazing amount of momentum.
We're talking about the situation in Venezuela, how that's playing internationally within the hemisphere and also locally within South Florida. You can call with your questions, comments, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text at 786-786-7636. We're here with Tim Padgett with WLRN and Franco Ordonez with McClatchy Media in Washington, D.C. We got this text message in from Andrea in Miami. I'm a Venezuelan national. I have heard in many media sources that Guaido is a self-proclaimed president. He is not. He is following a constitutional process that calls for the National Assembly president, which Guaido is, to become interim president when there is no constitutional president. Maduro was not constitutionally elected. It is important to make that distinction. Certainly is, Andrea. We appreciate that. Franco, what are the administration's expectations when it comes to Guaido, when it comes to the person that they felt comfortable enough to come out and declare that is the person that they see as the legitimate leader of Venezuela?
I mean, they see Guaido as the interim president. I understand that the caller is raising questions about that distinction, and I think those distinctions are very, very valid. For the administration, at least when I talk to have conversations with them, they see Guaido as an interim president because he has not been elected in a presidential election. Certainly, they see him as the legitimate democratically elected leader. But there are, you know, after this, we shall see what is Guaido's future. Certainly, they are so rallying behind Guaido. I mean, it's amazing the support that he's received inside the country as well as around the region and the world. That is one of the issues that the administration has been waiting for months in order to give a stronger push. As Ambassador Trujillo said, we are at a moment now that we were not at, you know, 6 months ago, even, you know, 6 weeks ago, and so much of that has to do with Guaido.
No, and that's very true. And I think one of the dilemmas here, Guaido has been such a galvanizing leader these past few weeks, and surprisingly so. He just came out of nowhere. But the fact is, he is only 35 years old, and he hasn't had a lot of governmental experience. So the problem becomes, if he's just the interim president and let's say we are able to call special presidential elections fairly soon, is Guaido the man who would then we would want to be the next president of Venezuela, or do we have to revert back to, frankly, a lot of these older, politicos from Venezuela's past who have really checkered histories, who kind of represent the old ancien regime in Venezuela, who created the conditions that brought the socialists and Hugo Chavez to power in the first place in Venezuela. That's going to be a real dilemma. What kind of leadership do we want once this rotted regime falls?
Yeah, and Franco, is that kind of discussion, I got to imagine it's very active and dynamic happening within the administration, as Ambassador Trujillo is confident that the kind of regime change is coming to Venezuela in weeks, if not months, in his estimation.
Absolutely. It's absolutely something that they're discussing. This, you know, who is going to take the mantle has been perhaps the biggest question inside and around the administration about what would happen. As Tim was just saying, the fracturing of opposition leadership in Venezuela has been so pronounced. It's been so difficult for them to agree on a direction for Venezuela that, you know, the United States and other regional allies have had struggled to be like, okay, if it's not Maduro, then what? Then who? There has not been confidence. There hasn't been a mechanism to change leadership, to change resources. It was Guaido and his galvanizing force, and acknowledging that he is the legitimate in the eyes of the United States, in the eyes of the region, that has at least given them a path for kind of these next steps.
Franco, what about Cuba? In the foreground, certainly within the past week or so, you've done reporting on this. We asked Ambassador Trujillo about the role of Cuba. How is that continuing to influence perhaps the actions that the administration is taking toward Venezuela?
In recent months, and kind of like this new regime at the National Security Council, led by John Bolton, who came in and replaced McMaster, Cuba has become kind of like the new favorite, one of the new favorite adversaries of kind of like the Western Hemisphere affairs area. The previous administrations will not tell you that Cuba didn't have a role in Venezuela. It always has been. But this new group of leaders, led by Bolton and Mauricio Clavercarón, as well as Rubio and Trujillo, they certainly have, you know, put down the hammer and saying we are going to hold Cuba more responsible and show to the world that Cuba has a role. It has been a very fascinating kind of change.
How are they doing that,
pressure.
Though, Franco? How do they plan to do that? Not to illustrate it, but to your point, to try to exert some pressure to Havana through Caracas.
Well, one is they're trying to build kind of international support. You mentioned Brazil earlier and their support for Guaido. Brazil just came out yesterday and also spoke out vociferously in opposition of Cuba and Cuba's role. But they're also, but the United States is also looking at sanctions and other measures that they can take. For example, looking at some of the Title III of Helms-Burton rules, can they kind of open up some lawsuits against individuals who lost property in Cuba. Other sanctions, they're looking at individual sanctions. They're looking at blocking the potential MLB relationship was kind of struck because they do not want any money to go to the government of Cuba.
And we should also mention putting Cuba back on the state sponsor of terrorism list.
Which was one of the last steps that the Obama administration made before the beginning of normalization.
Which is also risky because that one in particular could go a long way toward alienating the Latin American cooperation we've developed against Venezuela.
Quick call here from Tomas in Miami. Go ahead, Tomas. Thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Thank you very much. You know, the Castro regime and that controls the Maduro regime, and the Castro regime and the Maduro regime are completely anti-American. They always have been, and they will remain so. So the present policy doesn't lose anything, even if it fails. I don't think it's going to fail, but it doesn't lose anything at all. There's nothing to lose when your opponent that you're trying to change is totally anti-American and remains so. There are totalitarian societies that have a complete control of everybody and everything, right? And there is no question about the control of the Castro regime or the Maduro regime.
Yeah, Tomas.
There's no question that they are anti-American. There's nothing to lose.
That is true, Tomas.
And the fact that the Obama administration was pro-Castro doesn't change that.
Right, but Tomas,
the administration was totally pro-Castro.
Tomas, let me ask you real... Tomas, let me ask you real quick. Do you feel that, say, tomorrow, for example, if the Venezuelan regime were to fall, do you think that it would have the domino effect then to get rid of the Castro regime?
Did you see what happened in Regla, in the city of Regla, just 5 days ago, where the so-called president that the Castros put there was booed away, that he's coming, they have to run away from the city of Regla? There's a tremendous opposition in Cuba.
Yeah.
Cuba will last just weeks. Okay? The fact that the Obama administration is pro-Castro doesn't make anything right.
Tomas, thank you for the perspective. We appreciate that. We've also gotten some text messages reminding us about the situation in Nicaragua as well, Franco. How is that figuring into the administration's actions toward Venezuela?
As Ambassador Trujillo said, it's the troika of tyranny John Bolton has, you know, taken this administration and Trump as well in his State of the Union addresses, not this one, but the last one, of kind of indicating that he is going to take a much much tougher role on what he describes as communist governments, dictators, these authoritarian leadership, at least in this hemisphere, like Nicaragua, like Venezuela, and obviously Cuba.
Yeah.
They have been doing so many more sanctions against Nicaragua, and certainly Also, I will note that in the region, Nicaragua, turning to Nicaragua next, has a lot of support across the region. The caller was raising, saying the same thing about Cuba and Venezuela. The region doesn't necessarily all feel the same way about Cuba, but Nicaragua, it does.
Franco, we got to leave it there. Franco Ordonez with the McClatchy in Washington, D.C. at the NPR headquarters. Franco, thanks for sharing your reporting with us here.
Thanks for having me on.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us on WLRN. Always a pleasure, sir.
Thank you, sir.
If you want to become one of our listener networks, you can text us at 786-786-7636 here on the South Florida Roundup. That conversation continues. The program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Engagement producers Katie Lepre, Teresa Frontado, Digital Director, Terrence Shepard, News Director, Alicia Zuckerman, our Editorial Director. The Director of Radio Operations is Peter J. Mertz, and Director of Radio Programming Technical Supervisor Jason Sapka. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend.